Ready to dive in? Welcome to Adventures in Truth Podcast. Every episode, we explore, expand, and evolve our understanding of the truths we encounter and experience in our human quest for clarity and exponential growth. And now welcome your hosts, Dr. Jeffrey Smith and Jim Case. Welcome to Adventures in Truth Podcast.
Good evening. Dr. Jeff here with my good friend Jim Case.
Good evening, good evening.
Tonight, we are going to jump into a topic that is near and dear to my heart and something that I get to use multiple times during the week in my practice, and a term that everybody has heard, but not too many people are able to give a really good working definition to, and that is mindfulness. So tonight we would like to jump into, what is it? How do you use it? What are its benefits? Why do people talk about this? What is this thing with mindfulness? What is it to be mindful? Full of mind. So we all have some probably unique definitions of what this is, and I'm going to share what it is to me tonight, and Jim's going to add his commentary and how he uses it, and I'm going to share how that shows up for me in the work that I do with the folks that come to me to help them be more mindful and what the benefits of that are. So I'm going to use some notes that I put together and have used for a while, but we're just going to kind of loosely dabble with that and just have a good open conversation. So Jim, kind of over to you. I'm just going to pitch to you before we get into any PowerPoint slides. I'm happy to keep going with this, but I want to kind of do a generic, kind of a gentle walk into this thing.
Okay.
And, you know, since it's my topic, I could dive right in and just jump and run with the thing. But I'm curious as to, you know, I asked you to meet and, you know, let's kick this around. And what is mindfulness to you?
Well, if I had to boil it down, I think that for me, mindfulness ultimately is about presence in the immediate moment and right now.
Mm-hmm.
Mindfulness is what brings us to being present in now, however that looks. And it's, I think that it, at least from my perspective in terms of metaphysics, gets stretched a lot, you know, that it becomes this big thing of always paying attention to every thought you have and changing every thought you have, and that's actually not humanly possible. It's a process you can indulge in that for lack of a better word, you know, is a bit of a less intense expletive. To me, it's a bit of a mind fuck.
Uh-huh.
It's because instead of keeping it simple, which is through mindfulness, meaning through attention, through intention and attention, I'm going to be present here, and I'm not going to let my mind take me to the past or to the future. I'm going to be here, and then I'm going to make decisions and choices from that mindful place. Then I'm going to be in that presence of who I am, which is the only place you can actually, which we've talked about before, is the only place you can get to a shifted state. It's the only place you can shift state from, is
mm-hmm.
right here, right now.
Mm-hmm.
And so if you can use mindfulness as a way to get present, then you can do whatever you do that helps you to expand that state, which shifting state is just expanding that nowness in a way that is that makes it predominant in your experience instead of where your mind wants to take you.
Mm-hmm.
So, short version.
What would be an example of one state versus another to shift state?
Well, for me, the classic example is what I work with my clients all the time is about the choice between being in a fear-driven experience and an opportunity-driven experience. When you shift state and engage the prefrontal cortex and engage that part of the brain, you're putting yourself into an opportunity-based experience because now you're not limited by the blinders of what the mind wants to compartmentalize, because in the present is everything and nothing all at the same time. So mm-hmm. The shifting from the fear-based experience for me is the attachment to or the overwhelming focus on the things that stimulate survival, the things that stimulate the idea of this is what I did yesterday, so if I did this yesterday and I'm still alive, then I'll do this tomorrow because it'll keep me alive tomorrow, and then I'll do it the next day because it'll keep me alive, until something happens that says that that's no longer going to keep me safe. But none of those choices are based in mindfulness. Those are all based in reaction.
Right. So, like rubbing a lucky rabbit's foot.
Yeah.
Picking a four-leaf clover. Doing the, whatever that's called,
the cross.
Before you go up to bat to hit a home run.
Yeah.
As if God's going to vote for you as the batter and not the pitcher.
Pitcher.
Because you're on different teams or something. I never understood that. What should the pitcher do? What if they were both doing that at the same time? Wouldn't that be interesting? You ever watched Major League Baseball?
Well, the pitchers usually do it after, right? The pitchers, after they strike them out, they do this number. And go, thank
oh, like
you God.
They're giving thanks?
Yeah, yeah, thank you, God, for making me more powerful.
Oh, here we go again, talking about religion. Huh? We can't help ourselves. We just can't help ourselves. So, but that would be an example of really not being mindful, because if somebody really thought about what they were doing, they'd have to go back to a point in time where they learned it. Mm-hmm. Somebody told them, if you do this, good things are going to happen. And I guess it happened enough that it became a habit. But is that really being mindful? I think we'd probably have to say no.
Yeah.
It's not being mindful at all.
Yeah, it's one of those things that I happen to be a bit of a, or used to be, I don't know that I am so much anymore, but I was an awards show junkie. I used to, every year, I would watch all of them. You know, from the Academy Awards, the Emmys, the Tonys, the all of them. I just loved watching them. I got a kick out of watching them. But one of the things that drove me nuts, every time they get on stage, and they go, thank God, Jesus, thank you for... I'm like, what? Jesus wasn't there when you were doing what you did. I mean, he might have been hanging around somewhere.
But it would imply that he wasn't there for the people that didn't get chosen.
Exactly.
Right? Like,
yes.
He's got favorites.
Yes.
And you favorite
me. Right. I'm the favorite right now. And then without that, somehow you would not show up.
Interesting. What else about mindfulness? We're just kind of like broad brushing right now.
What else about mindfulness? I don't think mindfulness is about indulging the thoughts in your mind. Meaning, I'm talking about what I think it isn't. Mindfulness is not attending to your mind. In my way of thinking,
like following it.
Yes, it's not about dive into your mind and see what you can discover and understand about yourself,
because mm-hmm.
that's not where it is. That's just noise. That's just the radio signal that the receiver is on, and it's receiving all kinds of nonsense that good, bad, or indifferent really has very little to do with your.
That's a good description,
like reality.
It's not tuning the radio station just to see what stations you can tune into. It's not that.
Right. Where through mindfulness you tune to a very specific station.
Ah, there you go.
To a very clear
mm-hmm.
station that
mm-hmm.
has lots of amplitude and has lots of.
And it's what you want to listen to. Makes you feel good.
Yeah.
So we, in a previous podcast, I might have shared, I don't remember the year the study was done or the name of the study, But what did impress me enough to remember the study was that good study includes a large number of people. A good study also includes a cross-section of people. So young and old, variety of cultures, were asked to capture their thoughts. Write them down. Put them in a voice recorder. However you want to do it, capture your thoughts for as long as you can stand it. Those were the directions of the study. And then gathered together a panel of judges. They got all the thoughts. And the judges had a simple task. When you read this thought, does this make you want to smile or make you want to frown? Is this a happy thought or a sad thought? Is this a positive thought or a negative thought? It was some kind of a simple direction like that. And so this went through a panel of judges. So you got to judge them all, then I got to judge them all, and they got to judge them all, and then that was all averaged together. 70% of the people's thoughts turned out to be negative. So one of the directions that I omitted was just record your thoughts as they come. So this isn't a meditation exercise, and it's not a guided imagery where we've got a target. We're trying to do that. This was a random, whatever comes, come. Just observe what comes with no structure, with no intention. So 70% of all of the thoughts from this cross-section of numerous people were determined to be, whether it was minor league negative or major league negative, 70% of the time it was going to be more frowny face than smiley face. That's a huge number. That's a big number.
Yeah.
So that tells me that the human race, left alone, without intention, is going to be 70% of the time more bothered, frustrated, distressed, upset, anxious, whatever you want to call it, than those who say, wait a minute, I want to be the one who's tuning in to the thoughts I want to have. I want to be specific. I want to be guided. I want to be intentional. I want to be focused. I'm willing to be responsible for what plays on the speakers in my imaginary metaphoric radio here, right? Yeah. So this was somewhat of a groundbreaking study that helped formulate the science of mindfulness, or the study of mindfulness, what is it that people are kind of just doing on their own? What's just happening? What is the background? What are we working with here?
Mm-hmm.
So knowing that, left alone, 70% of the time we're going to be more distressed than we are going to be comforted, or more discontent than we are going to be content, that's a great place to start from. And if you take away nothing else from our podcast tonight other than that, that's a pretty important universal truism, that unless you want to be distressed, you have to get involved and choose what you're going to be thinking about. And so it's that choice. It's choose, like you said. I have to choose what I'm going to be thinking about if I want to be content. And that's the piece there, that I have a choice.
I would actually ask that you consider a different word, in that it is not about the thoughts. That's where I think the trap is.
Okay.
Because in shifting state, it's not about thinking, it's about being.
Mm-hmm.
So if the focus is on thought, then you're chasing, it's the dog chasing its tail. It's the same animal. It's just going round and round in circles, because you can become aware of thoughts, which I think is different than tracing your thoughts. Because there are, in my experience, there's a lot of thoughts that go through here that have nothing to do with me and have nothing to do with anything that's going on. I mean,
right, just like in the room right now, there's a zillion different radio waves.
Radio waves and the people that have been sitting here today, and somebody left a cloud over in that corner, and somebody, you know,
right?
Somebody had some thing that they didn't want to look at, they pushed it over there. You know, so there's all kinds of things that can go on in that dynamic. But so I think it's important, from my perspective, that we not tie this to or that it not be tied to the idea that it's about thinking, because it's not about thinking, to me. That's going to happen. The brain does what it does. The receiver is receiving all the time. I'm always amazed at the crap that goes through my head that has no relevance to what's going on in my immediate environment.
Okay.
Right? And it's actually led me to question, in a very big way, about this idea of as we transform our experience, as we expand in consciousness, what I observe is that you get better at filtering out that experience. It doesn't ever go away. That mind noise never goes away because you have a brain and it's tuned. And part of it is always tuned to the human experience because it has to be in order for the body to do what the body needs to do. So that's the idea that the ego is the consciousness that runs the physical vessel. It's always going to be doing its thing because it's connected to this physical present reality, where the expansion of that or the being in this space is somewhere else. That's connected to the spark. That's connected to the connection to the universal energy or God or whatever that is. And that as that expansion takes place, you create more space for beingness and less space for noise. So mindfulness is attention to space, not attention to the brain, not attention to the thoughts. You can be aware of them because if they're persistent, then you can say, wow, I noticed that I'm having this thought all the time. Stop. Shift state. Now find out. Now ask the question. What is this thought attempting to show me? What is this? Because now I'm looking at it from opportunity. I'm not looking at it from fear. The thought itself was probably generated from the fear experience, whether it's attached to mass consciousness, whether it's attached to significant other, whether it's attached to religion, whether it's attached to authority, whatever it is. The negative thought is coming from that space.
Okay.
So I'm tracking.
I may have gone way too far.
No, but you really dove in where I would. I want to break all of that down and help people who haven't read the books and spent the time that we have gotten the opportunity to do can dive in a little in slow motion.
Got it.
So one of the things I asked you to define was an example of a state change. And the rest of what I heard you say, I think we're saying the same thing, maybe using some different words and concepts that we might be able to come to some more alignment. And you also never used the word that you asked me to consider changing the word choice and thought to something else. So do you remember what that word would be?
No, that we not use that word. That we not use thought as a part, you're not going to think your way into mindfulness. You're not going to think your way into beingness. The two are on two different planets. So the shift in state comes when... So, if we're just focused on what the five senses present, we're focused in that survival brain. We're focused in, because that's what all the senses filter through, that part of the brain, right? The sight, the smell, all of the senses are there to keep us apprised of our environment, so that we know whether we're going to be safe or not safe, whether we're going to stay alive or not stay alive.
Mm-hmm.
That's a function of being physical on the planet. Shifting state is, to me, that you go from the attention to what's happening in that physical sense experience and saying, that's fine, that can happen over here. I'm going to move into a different state. I'm going to go from that into a place of beingness. Beingness is not tied to physicality. It's not tied to being in a body. It's tied to being whatever you believe that is. Whether you think that's it can be your sense. No, that's not right. Actually, I don't want to go there because the shift in state into beingness is a disconnection. It's a
step back. When we operate from a space of, from that fear-based experience, there's a construct that I work with that is about the process of change, which is be, do, have. And that be, do, have happens because out of beingness, we're inspired to doing something that is related to our inspiration, and in that translation, then, the havingness comes.
Okay.
So, the process of manifestation, however you want to look at it. So, in order to get there from here, you can't think your way into beingness so you can have. But what we've done in the paradigm of being focused in the fear-based experience is we've taken the have, excuse me, we've taken the do, and we put the do at the beginning of the phrase. And so we've decided that in that framework, if I'm doing something, if I'm doing, then I'll be successful, then I'll be happy, then I'll have what I want, but I got to keep doing, I got to have my lists, I got to go here, I got to do this, I got to talk, blah, 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 I got to have my doing thing going on. And that's how our whole culture is structured, is in doing.
So human doings rather than human beings.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Except we're not human doings, we're human beings. Mm-hmm. Which sounds very patronizing, but it's still very true in that when you shift state, you leave that doing place and go to a being place. And the being place is the place of being willing to just be present in what's happening this moment and allowing yourself to be inspired by what's happening in this moment, which then propels you to an action of some sort, which I call inspired action. There is action without inspiration, but you do that over here in the fear-based place. You don't do that in the being-based. Because in the being-based space, in that state, you recognize that there is nothing to do. In this moment, in this space, in this now, there is nothing to do unless I'm inspired, because everything that I'm taking in and absorbing and being with is now has the opportunity to penetrate my awareness. It has the ability to take the funnel off my face from and I'm putting my hands over my eyes so that you see that I'm wearing goggles, because my goggles limit my perception. But when I take the goggles away, there's a whole lot to see that wasn't there, but that I couldn't see before. And that's all of the opportunity that exists that allows you to then make conscious choices, mindful choices, about what you're going to take your step into. Because you recognize that the choice is not based in fear, the choice is based in where I want this to go. I'm inspired because all of this amazing beauty and all of this amazing experience, and it could, I mean, it's everything, but that applies to all the practical stuff of life too. To be inspired into anything and everything, whether it's a job, a relationship, money, there are all two different states. There's the fear-based state and there's an opportunity-based state. There's the doingness state and there's the beingness state. And they have very different impacts and very different outcomes. Did that still answer the question?
Well, we're slowing it down and trying to spread it out a little bit. This thing that you were saying, that it seemed like you were giving some pushback or resistance to the idea that mindfulness is only being aware of thought and choosing thought. Because that, to me, that we're just getting warmed up. We're just breaking the surface here.
No, deep end of the pool, please. Deep end.
So let's start out with some physiology.
Yeah.
We'll do body, and then we can shift into field, and I'm going to work time into the equation here and being aware of where your thoughts are. It's awareness is another key word. So, you know, audience, please, if you're taking notes or making a mental note, awareness is a very key word in the science or study or practice of mindfulness. And most people don't want to be aware. And if we're just willing to be aware, that helps. That's one of the key helpers here, key ingredients. So ventral vagal nerve goes from, I'm pointing to my forehead, mm-hmm. prefrontal cortex, all the way down. It passes the limbic structure, goes down past the parietal lobes, hits the brainstem, down through the cerebellum before the brainstem, hits the throat area where we have the something gland, thyroid gland, thank you. And then we bring the heart into the equation, and the stomach, and then all the way down to the tailbone. So 3 foot long nerve, ventral vagal nerve. It sends input both up from tailbone to brain all the way to the prefrontal cortex and vice versa. It's two-way signal, up and down. And those body parts, those the list that I just kind of went through, give us an opportunity to know what's going on. And those are our sensors. Those are like the gentleman that we watched the video a few weeks back talked about. Joe, and I can't remember the other guy's name, but the sensors that are out there in our body that we get to use to help us perceive and sense. thank you. So at the bottom end, people know when their stomach is flip-flopping. People know when their stomach is calm. Or we use terms like, I've got butterflies in my stomach. And moving up from there, we got the heart. It either pitter-patters, or it beats soundly, or we're not noticing at all, or it feels like it's jumping through my chest. I mean, we have all these different expressions for heart awareness. Mm-hmm. Heavy heart, all these different terms. The thyroid gland in the throat either keeps the airway open so that I can breathe easily, or it constricts and it shuts it down, which would inhibit airflow, which would, in a moment, I'll go through, but it forces us into the parasympathetic branch of the autonomic nervous system, which puts us in the freeze mode. So moving up from there, the brainstem, you know, lots of interesting things happening in the brainstem. When we push past that into the cerebellum we call the alligator brain or the reptilian brain, and it's primarily focused on avoiding danger, seeking food, or reproducing. I love it how women sometimes will refer to men as snakes, and that's not a Freudian thing for penis envy, I don't think anyway. Maybe for some it is. But largely it's about, wow, you're acting like a reptile right now, and primarily focused on wanting to have sex or reproducing. So that's interesting, and clearly the male hormone testosterone and the size of that particular part of the brain for men is larger. So yeah, we are going to show up that way more often. The drive is stronger. Moving up from the reptilian brain into the limbic structure, center of the brain now, common to all mammals. So we call that the mammalian brain. I know you know all this stuff, but I'm going through all this for the audience mm-hmm. that may not know this, and it might be of benefit for them to just simply get an idea of how all this ties into our sensors and being mindful. So what's interesting about, to me, what's interesting about the mammalian brain is mammals work in groups. They have the ability, dolphins have the ability to murder. And they also have the ability to love and nurture. You know, think about chimpanzees or the higher order primates have similar capabilities that human tribes or human clans or pods or groups or couples do. But what's interesting about the mammalian brain is that it has some subparts, thalamus, hypothalamus, and the amygdala. And the thalamus and hypothalamus are somewhat redundant structures, but they're like the ultimate hypochondriacs are the ultimate little sensors out there. And if they were like on each side of the brain, I'm putting my thumbs up right now. Like they start out in the thumbs up position with, and one says to the other, are you okay? Yeah, I'm fine. Are you sure? Yes, everything's good. Everything's good. Everything's good. You sure? Every moment, every second of every moment, they're sensing and perceiving, is the world right? Is the world okay? And then all of a sudden there's a bump or a thump or there's a smell. Or there's a sound, or there's something that moves, or a little black thing that runs across the floor, and this one goes, no, it's not okay, and the other one goes, I agree, sound the alarm. And then the amygdala gets involved, and it goes, and here's all the times it's happened before. So now we have ample evidence to sound the alarm, to shut off the prefrontal cortex, because Houston, we have a problem. Mm-hmm. And we don't have time for the prefrontal cortex to get involved in problem solving, which we'll talk about in a moment. We only have what we're created with to do is sound the alarm, and the alarm is fire off the autonomic nervous system. So the signal gets sent to the autonomic nervous system in the mammalian brain. of which humans have this part of the brain, as well as all mammals. So there's two branches that the signal goes down, and then there's a fork in the branch, and one goes to the sympathetic branch, which is, should I fight this thing that I perceive as an issue right now, or should I run away from it? And there's somehow, there's this little guy or little lever, or there's some kind of a, you know, which way do we go here at the branch between sympathetic and parasympathetic branch. And some of this is believed to be habituation, and I've done it so many times as a kid that it's believed that we have a dominant reaction, and sometimes it's not the right one because it's a dominant. And we'll talk about that in a moment. But there's either the run away from it, fight back, or the freeze mode. And so that was back to, I mentioned the thyroid gland. The thyroid and the heart are the indicators of my heart is beating slowly or quietly, and my throat is like, it feels like I can't get my words out right now, or I'm having a hard time breathing. You know that your parasympathetic branch has been triggered, and there's something happening, whether you're consciously aware of it or it's in the subconscious or the unconscious mind. There's something that have fired off the thalamus and hypothalamus and the amygdala to send the signal, and now I'm frozen, and I'm literally like I can't move, or I can't think, or I have a brain fog. And I work with so many adults that were traumatized as kids, and as a kid, you can't fight back against an adult perpetrator. You can't run away. Where are you going to run to? You're just going to have to come home, and it's going to be worse when you get home, so you learn to freeze. And you learn to dissociate and go somewhere else until it's over. What's also of interest to me, and we may have talked about it in a previous podcast, but here we go again. All the animals can be divided into those three different groups of the fighters, the runners, or the freezers. The fighters are the ones with the fangs, or the long teeth, and the claws, and the runners are the long legs and the tall ears, and the freezers are the ones that pull into a shell or wrap up in a ball, or they are camouflaged really well and they can blend in and until the danger's gone. And we have the ability to do all three. So some, you know, animals are kind of like categorized in those three groups, but as
evolution.
Yeah. King of the pack here, we can do all three. What I find interesting in my practice is that adults that had the dominant response of freeze as a kid, and that was the right response as a kid, are doing the same thing as an adult, and they don't feel good about it because now they have the size, the speed, the skill, the resources to fight back, say no, have a boundary, run away, punch them in the face, kick them in the balls, whatever. They have the ability to do that now, but they're still choosing freeze mode, and it feels awful to them. And you know, that's what they come in to seek help with, that we could redirect that if there's even really any danger present at all, which oftentimes isn't. It's fear, and we've talked before about the difference between fear and danger. One's real, one's not real, right? So an example of that for the audience would be danger is being at the zoo when the tiger's out, and it's not a friendly tiger. It's not one that you can walk up and touch and pet. Fear is the last time I was at the zoo, the tiger got out, and I'm afraid that it's going to happen again. So one is real, it's really happening, it's really there, and the other one is, it's imagined. All right, believe it or not, all this ties into mindfulness. I didn't talk about the prefrontal cortex, and we've chatted a little bit about it, but it's relevant to our conversation tonight. The prefrontal cortex, the part of our brain that makes us human, that primates don't have, is the part that sits over our eyeballs. You know, it's about 2 inches, it protrudes out about 2 more inches, and it's wide and everything. It's the part that has empathy, judgment, compassion, understanding, kindness. You know, think of it like the board of directors, or maybe the executive decision-making piece. And when the world is okay, and there's not a crisis going on, meaning that thalamus and hypothalamus are thumbs up, everything's good, it's good to have a board of directors in your organization. It's good to include executive decision making. It's good to take the time to send out a sample, gather the results, and you know, analyze and then make a decision. That's all good. That's higher order thinking and higher order being, if you will. So it's really only when there's a true crisis going on that that part of our humanity gets shut down and isn't included. So think about cultures that are at war with each other. They got bombs going off all the time. Their thalamus and hypothalamus are constantly in thumbs down mode, and they're not able to be kind and live the golden rule and have compassion, and because they're constantly in that fight, flight, or freeze mode. And a lot of them are in the fight mode. I'm going to kill you, you MF-er, or whatever.
Is that a real assessment? Is that the reason I asked that question is that so much, especially lately, I've been seeing and hearing really powerful disconnects from our perception of what people in those circumstances are going through and the reality of what they are experiencing. And I have seen in those circumstances, I don't disagree with you about the flight experience, or the fight or flight experience, more that actually there is a lot more compassion and there's a lot more of that experience, not maybe with all people, but with a lot of people in that circumstance, because they're all suffering the same experience, so they're there, so there's a tendency to support one another.
Right, I'm talking about opposing sides.
They would have
that hatred, or it just perpetuates itself.
Gotcha. Okay.
Because I'm in fight, flight, or freeze mode.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a good question. Okay, so we went through all of the systems within our body that are these perceivers, these sensors, and it is not possible to practice mindfulness if your thalamus and hypothalamus are easily triggered, because your amygdala is full of traumatic events and memories that are easily provoked and are telling you you don't live in a safe world. Your world is not okay. Mm-hmm. So even though you're in your 30s now and you were molested in, you know, your years 1 through 10, you're never going to be molested again. That's an eye-opener for a lot of people. That doesn't mean you won't be raped or accosted or mugged or something. But Uncle Bill is not going to come up to you at age 30 and start grabbing your boobs or your crotch. Not going to happen, like ever. As a 30-year-old, that just isn't going to happen. Now, I'm not saying there are no exceptions to that. But
well,
I'm saying
enough,
generally,
it could very well happen if their continuing thought process is, I'm a victim of this, I'm ripe for this. They can manifest and can create circumstances in their lives that perpetuate that abuse.
Well, they'll still be the victim. That's the perpetuation.
Yeah.
But Uncle Bill isn't going to ever molest you.
Uncle Bill, exactly right. Uncle Bill is not going to be touching you again. But if you are continuing to carry that, someone else will.
Oh, yeah.
Someone
absolutely
will take Uncle Bill's place that fast.
Right.
If need be.
So step one in this process is, if you can stay 30 and behave like a 30-year-old, that isn't going to happen to you ever again. And number one, you can kick him in the balls, you can slap him in the face, you can say no, you can cuss him out, you can dial 911. There's all these resources that you have today that you didn't have then. And so that's an aspect of being mindful and not immediately taking a trip back in time. And what's interesting about people who are traumatized, and all the research that's been done on trauma, is that the age that it happened becomes like stamped as, when those circumstances show up again, you forget that you have all the resources that you have at your current age. It's as if you forget all that and you go back to, I have to deal with this like a 10-year-old mm-hmm. or a 5-year-old, which is really fascinating. Maybe for a different topic, we can go in another time, we can go deeper into that. So we're kind of still playing around with this idea of being mindful and what it is and what the aspects of it are. And we've gone through some of the physiology. So in order to be mindful, you have to be in a place, a literal place, a physical place, where there are not bombs going off and you're running for your life. There really can't be danger present to be in this state of, I'm using mindful in this case, more like I'm at peace with the world. there is a time and a place to fight, to run, and to freeze and wait for the danger to pass. And in those conditions, because I'm what I'm saying is mindfulness requires the prefrontal cortex to be present and on, you would simply be flowing in a high state of perfected autonomic nervous system response. You would be choosing the right path of fight back, run away, or freeze. You could say that's being mindful, but it's kind of hard to do that if the part of the mind that's required to show up and participate in that is literally offline. And we have brain imaging and other ways of showing that, it's like a light switch. There's literally a severing of that part of the mind from the rest of it, that it's not able to participate and show up that way. Kind of an interesting topic, and we can dive into that if you want to, and it's debatable, but you want to go there?
Well, it does beg, at least in the broad stroke of how we've approached this podcast and what we're bringing to the table, and that is where... No.
I know what I brought to the table.
Yeah. The... what if, and I'm posing this as a little bit of a counterpoint, but not necessarily a counterpoint, more deep in the conversation. So what if all of those experiences are about the contrast that we experience that forces us or drives us to find the state of beingness, regardless of circumstance. Rather than making it be about the circumstance, make it be about your alignment. Make it be about your ability to find your beingness, regardless of circumstance.
Yeah, I think that's possible. To me, it's you're describing the Jedi warrior who has been at war so many times and had so many bullets shot at them that their thalamus and hypothalamus are still able to stay in the up mode. Oh, I've done this a million times. I know how to do this. This isn't something that
But the big difference is the force is with them. If you're going to use Jedi, you got to take the whole picture.
Yeah, I'm willing to go there.
Right, you can't be a Jedi if you don't have mindfulness. You can't be a Jedi if you don't have that clarity. That what's going on here doesn't matter. What's going on here does. And the more I attend to that, the less this comes online.
Mm-hmm.
The less impact I can have on that if I'm not focused here. If I'm focused there, I'm not bringing all of that. So I don't know if that derails us, but I want to throw that in the mix only because I don't want to, from my perspective as a participant in this process that we're doing here, I don't want to put into people's minds more ideas that limitation is acceptable or limitation is necessary to the human experience. That because this is the way we've always viewed it in the arc of science, that this is the way it is. It's a viewpoint of an explanation that helps us to better understand, but it doesn't answer the question. It doesn't address the... We have an enormous amount of traumatized human beings on the planet,
mm-hmm.
For various reasons, whether it's sexual abuse or war or whatever. And yet there's a consistency to all of those experiences in that finding the way through, or is it that finding the way through is finding that place of mindfulness that gets you shifted out of the state of trauma? Because trauma in and of itself is its own state. And it's a state of self-perpetuating fear.
Mm-hmm.
So how do we focus in the self-perpetuating fear, or do we focus in the space that is not that?
Yeah. What is just rocketing through my mind right now was various times in my life when I've gone through training. The one that's most prevalent right now is carrier takeoffs and landings. And part of the training involved watching films of aviators who did not successfully do that and flew their airplanes right into the back of the ship.
Oh.
or they didn't determine the pounds of steam to put into the catapult strong enough so that their catapult resulted in them going straight off the boat right into the water, and or rough seas or poor communications or just a malfunction of equipment. But it brought an awareness of what you're about to do, you have to do really well, and the margin for error is almost non-existent. Mm. And you have to do it fearlessly. And in order to do that fearlessly, I can carry it. Go ahead, just let it go. In order to do it fearlessly, you have to have practiced it and had exposure so many times that it's not something that is actually showing up for you any longer as fear. And so we do that through simulation over and over again. So repetitive exposure over and over and over again to something that at one time created a high level of arousal. That's another way of saying fear. And arousal can be positive or negative, but in this case, being first shown that if you don't do this 100% correctly, it's not going to turn out good for you and other people. That's how the training began, that it was an attention gainer of, hey, you really got to be all here. You have to be fully present. They didn't use the term mindfulness at the time, but they could have, and today they might even be talking about that in this way. But it's really about decreasing level of arousal to where fear isn't present and increasing confidence that I can do this. I can do this. I can do this at nighttime. I can do this in pitching seas. I can do this in rain. I may not want to, but if those are the conditions and the mission is, you know, stated that we got to go do this or this is what we have to work with, I can do it in a way that I have low level of arousal and still have full faculties of my brain, and from my tailbone up to my prefrontal cortex, and the thalamus and the hypothalamus are saying, it, but it still stays up. It's not going into the down mode, and it's, you know, fine little subtleties that you're using to determine if you're okay or not. And then you do it, and you do it again, and you do it again in a simulator. And then at some point you go out and you do it on an airstrip that has a cable. So everything is the same, except it's an airstrip. It's not a real boat. And then you go out to San Clemente Island. And San Clemente Island, as you come in over the ocean, there's a cliff that represents the back of the boat, and then there's the airstrip. And you got a little painted box, and you have to put your airplane down in the painted box. And there's a cable there that you have to catch, and you get the whole experience. But it's still not a boat, because the island doesn't move, right? So then, you know, after you've mastered that, and you've done that a bunch of times, fly down over the ocean, go over land, hit the box, stop. Raise the hook. Park the plane, get gas, take off, and go do it again.
Oh, so would you say that's all behavior modification?
And yeah, you could call it that, but it's really reducing arousal.
The reason that I ask that question is because it doesn't sound to me. It sounds like behavior modification from the perspective that I wouldn't necessarily consider that state shifting.
Because I haven't got there yet.
Okay.
So at the point when you finally go out to the boat and you're flying above it at 10,000 feet and you look down and you're like, I'm going to land on that? And then you get lower and lower and it gets bigger and you do it and then you do it again and again and again, and then you do it at nighttime and you actually now, wow, this isn't a simulator anymore. This is real life. I can really feel the boat moving. I can see how the light changes when I'm coming behind it, and there's all these other airplanes out there and all this stuff on the radio, and you're in your zone. You're mindful. Your ventral vagal system is telling you, you can do this. You're okay. Even if there's another airplane that's running out of gas, or there's whoa, what was that? That helicopter took off. That's not good. You know that something just happened that they're going to do. And I'm here. I'm right here. I can only do this. Can't do that or anything else. I gotta be here all right now. And you learn how to do that. And you learn how to do it well. And then at some point, you actually even like, you like it. You like being in that place of all here, all right now. And if you're not, you know, you don't even want to think about what could happen if you're not. That's one aspect of being mindful. And we tied the whole physiology into it. I loved your question about, well, what you introduced the idea of may the force be with you when I used the term Jedi warrior. And, you know, that's something that is fun to talk about, but I don't know how much science we have behind it or how much, you know, whether that's spirit or energy or chi or prana, you know, that I want to go there. I want to have that part of the conversation too, and how that either impacts, influences, overrides, supports. You know, that part will be interesting for us to jump into that.
So how many, as you're talking, all that I keep hearing in my mind is about this, is clarifying the difference between, or is there a difference? Maybe the question is, it is the question in and of itself, is this idea of for people who have done that training,
mm-hmm.
and have been focused in that fashion and can execute in that fashion, how many of them can execute in that fashion through all aspects of their life?
Not many.
They can do it well here, which mm-hmm. is where I came, which I was asking about behavior modification. Because to me, the difference in true mindfulness, in true state shift, is that it's the whole of the experience, not a slice of the experience.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a little differentiation that goes on in the...
I'd like to think that if you could do it in a slice, you could expand your slice.
Well, and but that's eventually... to what I was saying before, mm-hmm. a little bit before about what we were talking about expanding... Here we go again. We were just talking about it just before you dove into this piece.
Hmm.
Anyway, go ahead. I'll remember it.
So up to this point in our discussion and podcast tonight, we're just pushing in, and I feel because of the number of times a week I talk about this and different venues I've presented it, we're still just in the introduction part of trying to talk about mindfulness. Mm-hmm. And we've made some assumptions, and maybe we need to clarify some assumptions. Some of my assumptions that if I was in my office right now and had some clients or patients in front of me, I'd be up on my whiteboard. I love using my whiteboard. It helps me explain a lot of things, mainly more for me than them probably. But I would be first drawing this formula of thinking precedes feeling that precedes behavior. And you're talking about being. And so to me, being is the behavior part of it, but it includes how I'm feeling, my emotion, and it also includes my thinking. So perhaps being includes all three, where I'm seeing it as a sequence that there's step one, two, and three.
Right, well, because again, being is about a state.
Mm-hmm.
Thinking is an activity.
Mm-hmm.
Feeling is not a state. It's an experience. It's a...
Okay, so being would include all three of those, though, right?
I mean, those
would be aspects of being, and to be, there was some thought, or is some thought, there is some emotion or some feeling, and there is some action or some behavior as a part of being. It would be difficult to be without those being part of being.
I would be more inclined to say that those activities fall under the doing category, in that beingness, and if you look at in Eastern philosophy and and the idea of meditation, the idea of transcendental meditation, the idea of all of those things is the absence of thought, or the space between thoughts, or no mind. So beingness is about being completely present in your experience without thought, without the engagement of the human faculty, but engaging the spiritual faculty. And once you are inspired in that being space, you shift into doing. Now the mind comes in and wants to figure out the hows and the whys, and the emotions come in and they do their thing about, do their dance about, you know. And again, depending on how you assess it, the emotions can be the guidance system that allows you to keep you focused into that state of being, because if you're staying in a positive emotional state, your being state is stable, because you and that being state, that connection to your higher self, are in alignment. You're
right.
Connected.
Right. If we could backtrack a little bit, maybe a half hour ago, you talked about that noise.
Mm-hmm.
Remember talking about noise that's always on?
Mm-hmm.
So there's always going to be some thought.
Mm-hmm.
There, if you've tried to meditate, there isn't a place where you get where there's just no signal and no noise, or it's rare. Maybe some Jedi mind warriors can do that, but it's rare to just have like nothingness for most people. And I don't know, for the state of our discussion tonight, we could say it's possible, but how likely is that, or even is that a goal for most people? I don't know.
So well, I think that's part of the practice. That's part of the things you do to sustain engage or to stimulate state shift, to stimulate the beingness, in that there's you can actually sit in a mindful space, in the space of now, and watch thoughts, but you can also watch the space between the thoughts.
Mm-hmm.
Or you can focus your awareness into the space between the thought and be in that space of no thing. And that's ultimately what I understand to be the ultimate goal, but it's like any muscle, it takes practice.
Mm-hmm.
It takes time and energy invested in the willingness to separate.
Right. On occasion, my girlfriend will ask me, "What are you thinking?" And on occasion, my response is, "I'm not, I'm feeling right now. I'm just being, I'm just here. There really is no thought, and it's wonderful. It's a place of bliss for me. I'm just, I call it like my bubble, and I'm inside my bubble." That's also, you can learn to develop that in a high-performance environment, too. When I'm driving my best in a race car, or when I have flown the best in a plane, it transcends mechanical list-following and checklists and do this and then that. You just, it's a knowing. It's a sense of I'm one with whatever it is
going on,
and I'm at peak performance or peak experience, and it's near orgasmic, actually.
Yeah. Well, I think you will find that that's true of any person who has learned how to perform, whether it's an athlete, whether it's,
mm-hmm.
you know, that when they're there, there is nothing else. And it's the most extraordinary experience that we are entitled to every day, not just in peak experiences that might show up once or twice. You know,
right.
I did an exercise in my presentations that I would do for clients, that I would ask them that question, what, tap into one of those peak experience moments, you know, and go back to it, feel into it. What did it feel like? What was it? How did you feel? You know, and then we would talk about the words, the descriptive adjectives they would use, and the one that was always the focus was about that feeling of invincibility, that nothing can touch me.
Mm-hmm.
But then you ask them, how long ago did you experience that? And easily 80% of the people, 10 years or more, since they experienced that feeling.
Mm-hmm.
Very few would have current experiences, and typically not huge experiences, but more minor type experiences. But most people could not come up with an experience that was
in their current reality. Which I thought was pretty fascinating.
Mm-hmm.
Very telling. And so we were talking about thinking, feeling, and behavior
mm-hmm.
as being part of being, whether it's being or doing. We'll keep that on the table and push into that some more. But the thinking aspect is really fascinating because there's so many assumptions that we're making about just using that word thinking. We have conscious thought, we have subconscious thought, we have unconscious thought. We have, in order to get to thinking, that's based off belief systems. It's based off of cultural programming, social programming, memes, the whole science of memetics. It's like, I don't even know, nobody can really tell you what they're thinking completely. There's no person on the planet that can really do that. Because we cannot actively access the subconscious and the unconscious, which our consciousness experts tell us, at best, we have about 18% of our mind that we can consciously access.
Mm-hmm.
So this is a big joke. Well, this whole thing, this whole experience of being alive on this planet, you're only giving me 18% to work with.
That to me is the crux of transformation and conscious evolution right there. Is I'm taking 18% that I started with, and my job is to bring above the conscious threshold as much as possible, because the more that becomes conscious, the greater percentage that expands to conscious.
Mm-hmm.
And the greater that expands to conscious, the greater my ability to interact and shift state and maintain that state, because those things that live below the conscious threshold now no longer have as much weight or as much intensity, because as the percentage increases in understanding, those things are no longer, once they come above the conscious threshold, you now have the ability to make decisions about them, you have the ability to change them, you have the ability to reprogram them.
Right.
You know, then we get into the laying down new tracks and you know,
right.
neural pathways and all that good stuff. And we could go
mm-hmm.
go back into the physiology.
Mm-hmm. So if we back up for a moment to the place where physiologically the ventral vagal system is not alarmed or aroused at all, the physiology would allow us to think the thought, I'm okay. That's just a basic thought. If there's okay and not okay, I'm okay.
Mm-hmm.
I like to take that next step to content versus discontent. And to be content, the feeling, mm-hmm. content is a feeling,
mm-hmm.
comes from the thought, I have what I need now. Now, some more assumptions here.
Mm.
So the goal is content. At the minimum, the bottom, the worst, you will, practicing mindfulness, being present in the now, in the moment, the worst outcome is content. The best outcome could be rapture, euphoria, bliss, way up there at the top. But the worst will be, I'm good. Which is not a bad place to be. If that's the worst you're going to experience is, I'm good, I'm okay, I'll take that. Versus, if you're not here in content, you're going to be out here in discontent. And the reason that I went both ways is because you have present, past, and future. And for people that can't see me using my hands right now, if you just put three lines on a paper and you go present, past, and future, you put present in the middle, and underneath that you put content. That's a great way to conceptualize on a whiteboard or a PowerPoint slide or some graphic thing of how we can put mindfulness together. In Einstein's work, in trying to create a unifying theory of everything, otherwise known as the theory of relativity, of which he really didn't do, everybody talks about it, but if you really study it, it never really happened. And other people really should have been given the credit for it, and that's not taking anything away from the brilliance of Einstein. It's just that he was given credit, like Columbus we talked about before, discovering America.
Yeah.
Didn't really go down that way. Nevertheless, from the attempt to create a unifying theory of everything, string theory and T theory, quantum physics, quantum mechanics, resulted in that pioneering work. And one of the byproducts of that was the awareness of time in the way that the human mind perceives time. Happens 8 seconds at a time. So there's a book out there called The 8 Seconds of Now. You can Google that, and there's a whole bunch of hits you'll get on our brain. For the most part, for most people, I try not to speak in absolutes, because there's always going to be somebody who wants to give me the exception, as if it disproves what I'm trying to say, rather than, it's just an exception! Go with it, man. Go with the main body of knowledge here.
Because of your perception, not because it's a type of perception.
Nevertheless, if you go to the seashore, waves come ashore about every 8 seconds. Go to the seashore yourself and time the waves. But also be mindful that there are seasonal effects and there are certain breaks and certain shoreline patterns. And, you know, there's, I'm not an expert on the whole wave thing, but on average, waves come ashore about every 8 seconds. And that's believed to be one of the reasons why, guess what, we like going to the beach. Because if our brain perceives time in intervals of 8 seconds, and you go to the beach, and that happens to be about every 8 seconds. It's like a natural metronome.
Mm-hmm.
It's just keeping time for us. There's also a high concentration of negative ions at the beach from the cascading of water, and our brain loves negative ions. So anywhere that you see a water fountain, cascading water, whether that you're on a boat, next to a waterfall, next to a fountain, rapids on a river, the waves at the beach, it's creating negative ions, and our brain loves it. So we're not really going there because of the waves and the water and all that. We're going there because our brain loves negative ions. Kind of funny when you start turning yourself on to some of these things. So I'm still going down the pathway of 8 seconds of now, and waves are one example of that. Another example would be classical music. Unbeknownst to Beethoven and Bach and all the masters of classical music, they did not know, but it was later discovered, that their composures hold our attention for about 8 seconds, and then there's some kind of a shift, and it goes on to something else. So you can kind of like see how it worked out that way. Somehow they intuitively knew that and wrote it that way, and that's why we gravitate toward it, and it stuck around this long. Good speakers will speak no more than about 8 seconds, and they'll pause briefly, let it sink in, keep going, or there'll be a natural back and forth. You go 8, I go 8, maybe 16, but then I pause, and you know, in between, and we go back and forth. It's irritating a lot of times to listen to somebody who violates that, and it feels like they got their finger on the trigger, and it's just, and the brain goes, I can't take that much. I need a pause there. Just let me get my 8 seconds and then another 8 seconds.
Mm-hmm.
We feel that internally. I used to know like 10 analog examples of the 8 second principle. I think I just gave 3. The fourth one I can remember. Go back in time with me to whenever people thought riding a bucking bronco or getting on a wild bull was a good idea. And they made a profession of it called the Professional Rodeo Association. And they had it in the beginning, in the very, very beginning, they had to have just had some other cowboys standing around, maybe a couple of them, that had a flag or some indication of, that's long enough. And then at some point, the that's long enough got timed. Guess how long you need to ride a bull for, bucking bronco for, to get credit for
ten
a ride?
Seconds?
No, it's actually 8. Yeah. Do we really think that's a coincidence? Because they didn't know anything about Bach or Beethoven or Einstein. They didn't know anything about it. It was an internal, that's long enough. And somebody put a stopwatch to it at some point, and it came up to 8 seconds. Mm-hmm. It's not 7 seconds, and it's not 9 seconds. It's eight. And to me, that's awesome. I laugh every time I go into that. So if we can make the assumption that the human mind works in intervals of 8 seconds at a time, and it's not like a film strip where you got a picture and then a little blank spot and then another one and they're segmented, it flows. So in my diagram, if I was on the whiteboard, there would be like part of the future 8 seconds is sticking into the now, and a tail piece of the 8 seconds that's leaving is still in the now. So there's a seamless flow of these things. The tail that's sticking in the now that's about to become the past allows me to follow that so I can archive it and go get it. Does that make sense? Like instead, like, okay, where is that? And I gotta go follow it in my mind and trace back in time to get to that memory. It allows for a constant stream of consciousness, if you will, to take us to all of our past experiences. They're not segmented.
That's very much NLP.
Yeah. And the piece of the future that hasn't really become the future yet, that's sticking into the now, allows me to flow. It allows me to duck and bob and weave and dance and duck and all those things that I need to, that otherwise would be collisions if it was just segmented. So, bottom line and all that, why did you go so far into the 8 seconds of now? Well, number one, because it's real, and I wanted to talk about it enough to at least stimulate some, if you doubt it or this is new to you, go check it out for yourself. You'll find out it's really awesome. When you get to the point where, I only got to do this for 8 seconds, whatever the this is, I only have to do 8 seconds at a time. I can pretty much do anything for 8 seconds at a time. So previously, I was sharing that to get to content, the thought process, part of mindfulness, the thought process would be the intentional thought process, the intentional choosing of what am I going to think about, because remember I said left alone will go negative 70% of the time. Mm-hmm. If you tell yourself I have what I need now, and now is only 8 seconds, that's not hard to do. Pretty much anybody can do that. And I've asked audiences, does anyone believe right now in this 8 seconds you don't have what you need? And I've had smart asses put their hand in the air, yeah, I need some more coffee. And I'm like, hey, does anybody want to get her some more coffee? And like within 8 seconds it, you know, shows up. And I was like, well, I guess the universe gave you what you needed. If that's truly a need, you got what you needed. Or I'll be the smart ass and I'll go, okay, let's test that. And we look to a clock. And we let 8 seconds go by, and I'm like, you still alive? And they're like, yeah, I'm still alive. I guess, well, that's not really a need, that's a want. So we're getting our wants and our needs. In mindfulness, if you practice need versus want, you'll land in content, like only every time. We get what we need, only always. That's a very, very, very comforting thought. So let's test that. We go back to your very earliest memories. We go all the way back. Some people can go back to 6 months, 2 years, something like that. There were a whole bunch of 8 second intervals of time that happened from your earliest memory to now, to the present, to this moment. And because you and I are here, and maybe this is a simulation, or maybe it is a hologram, or it's not real, and I can't prove what it is. But if this is real, if we're having whatever the experience is, in all of those 8 second intervals of time, guess what? We've gotten what we've needed because we're here. Mm-hmm. It's not just a theory. I mean, if this is real and you're real, Jim, I got some good news for you. Despite all the hardships and heartaches and tough challenges you've been through, you've always gotten what you've needed. And guess what? You have what you need now. And guess what? The universe isn't going to change its rules tomorrow. You're going to get what you need tomorrow too. And the next day, and the next day, all the way up until that day that you go to take a breath and your breather doesn't work, or you go to get another heartbeat and your heart doesn't work, that day is out there. But I haven't ever had anybody come into my office and into my practice saying, I don't know when or how I'm going to die. We all kind of accept that as part of our human condition, our state. But what I have almost everybody doing is coming in because they're not content with the time between now and the time they're going to die. They don't know how to do that and be content, which is my job to, I take that as my challenge to help them learn how to do that. So mindfulness is one way of practice. This is just one way of being mindful. This is Jeff's way of being mindful that seems to work for me, and I've certainly gotten to practice it myself, and I've been tested a lot, particularly this last year. If I just keep telling myself, instead of letting the 70% of the time frowny face show up, if I'm telling myself over and over and over again, no matter what's happening out here, I have what I need right now. And I only got to do it for 8 seconds. And then there'll be a new experience, slightly different. And if not, if the pain is the same, if the hardship is the same, well, guess what? I now have 8 seconds of experience with it that I didn't have before. And that's a big part of our discontent is the unknown, the fear of the unknown. And you hear people say, I can never do that. Or I would never want to do that again. And I'm like, why not? You did it well enough the first time that it would be easier the second time because you've been through it, right? It's just funny. I laugh a lot of times to myself at the stuff people say because they're not mindful.
Right.
Right?
Yeah.
So it's the ability to hear what you're saying, the conscious languaging, that's a piece of mindfulness, is actually hearing what you're saying. And no longer believing the stuff that you're saying because it's not true or it doesn't serve you that way. So 8 seconds of now is a big piece. I only have to do this for 8 seconds at a time. And I can pretty much do anything for 8 seconds. And that's never failed me once in my entire life. I've gotten what I've needed. And the difference between content and discontent is what's a want and what's a need. And our needs are pretty basic. And you don't even have to do anything. They just show up. You don't have to work to get your needs met. Needs will just show up. The universe wants to meet our needs. Everything else is a want. Most things are wants. Mm-hmm. And as you know, you've met people that seem to live the life that they get almost everything they want. Mm-hmm. Those people are no happier than the people who don't get almost anything they want.
Just haven't found beingness.
Right.
Any satisfaction. As you're talking, I've kind of gotten stuck on the word content. Because for me, contentment is a very mental word, as opposed to something like being satisfied or being satisfied is the one that comes up most, but so I wanted to take a second to flesh that out.
Okay.
In what does, how do you define contentment? What is that?
Well, I would start with the thalamus and hypothalamus are still giving thumbs up, that all of my ventral vagal system is green versus red or any of the other universal colors of alarm or arousal, but my physiology is not in a state of arousal at any level. That would be a starting place for how I would define content. So you talked about it being mental. Well, yes, it's mental, but it's also physiological and it's also emotional. So it's a word that you can put in all three of those domains. And you could even put my EM wave device on your earlobe and we could measure heart rate variability, and in that state of content you'd be in high coherence. Which I also, when you get into satisfied, to me that would be, so content would also be I'm not hungry, I don't have to pee, you know, it's like all those physiological things are okay. I'm not in a state of arousal, like really hungry
or like, I really gotta pee right now, and that's the only thing I can think of. Mm-hmm. You know, that would be the thalamus and hypothalamus saying, you're gonna make a mess, you're gonna embarrass yourself, you know, there's gonna be a problem here. So content's a cool word, and it can transcend the mental, the physical, and the physiological. And then it also served well in the model, because its opposite would be anything less than content, which we would call discontent.
Mm-hmm.
I think satisfied might have, you could probably overlap what satisfaction is versus dissatisfaction. But what comes to mind for me about satisfaction has to do with preference, or maybe even satiation. I don't know. They're interesting words. I like okay. I could have used okay, but there really isn't a good opposite of okay, other than calling it not okay. Jim is looking up. He's Googling right now.
Yeah, and it could, because actually content was... It's that's funny. So satisfied, the definition is for satisfied is contented.
Oh, that is funny. That really is funny.
And
so let's use that for a moment.
The content, because content was a pretty cool definition, actually.
What did it say?
In a state of peaceful happiness.
Okay, yeah.
So that answers the question.
Yeah, I found, and remember toward the beginning of our discussion, you were, there was, I called it pushback or resistance, and it was clarification that you were seeking. And I summarized that as, I think we're saying the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
This would be a perfect example of that, where it's like, hey, content doesn't work for me. I'm into satisfaction. And it's just interesting. It's like, yeah, pretty darn close to the same thing.
Yeah.
But we do that. Our minds do that. And this is, you know, this is a model you haven't seen before. So I've only seen it like, you know, 1,000 times or 2,000 times or something. And I'm believing the bullshit. I'm believing, you know, whether it's true or it's not, or I made it all up. For our audience, it could be 100% placebo. I know that if you practice it, it helps you feel better,
mm-hmm.
which to me is helpful. Even if it is all bullshit. It's kind of like, you know, do aliens exist or not? I don't know. Maybe. Does it matter? I don't know. I don't see
them. They show up on my doorstep? Probably not.
Well, what if they show up on your doorstep and say, hey, let's go boogie?
Right. You're
like, great. But, you know, they show up at your doorstep and got a gun to your head. You know, it's two different conditions.
Yeah.
And it's like, how do you want to see them? You know, I want to see them as, let's go boogie. Hey, show me your spaceship. I like to fly. What, can I fly it? That's probably what I would say. Hey, let me fly that thing. Interesting stuff. Yeah, so this is one way of talking about mindfulness. And perhaps in next week we'll push into the application of it and using some anecdotes of clinical examples of things I've gotten to share with people and how they've used it. If I could take a moment and get to share with you and the audience of how I got to use it last January, I found myself laying out on the desert.
Are we talking about mindfulness?
I'm talking about mindfulness, yeah. Yes. It, yes, thank
yeah.
you.
Yeah.
Thank you very much for... I find they and it disturbing and... Yet I continue to say those words, right? Thank you. Yes, I got to practice mindfulness the month of February last year in a way that I never have before. And it was like, that's why I called it possibly bullshit, you know, because you can tell yourself something over and over and over again that whether it's true or not, it's your own bullshit.
Mm-hmm.
But it helped me feel better, and it got me through a really, really difficult time in my life,
8 seconds at a time. I just kept telling myself, I only have to do 8 seconds. I don't know if I can do this for another 8 seconds, but all I got to do is 8 seconds. And things like tourniquets are not easy to feel your way through. And bandage changes that you see your arm just like, wow, it looks like I just got off of a torture device and they opened me up from every side and all the way to the bone. And this is blowing my mind. On all my receptor sites are on full alert and full alarm right now. My thalamus and hypothalamus and definitely thumbs down right now. And having to convince myself that I can do this and push through it and gained more experience. I've never had a tourniquet put on before. And I remember the guy that was putting it on, I kept asking him, why am I going to lose my arm? And he's like, well, how did you get there? And I said, well, in all of my military training, anytime you went to put a tourniquet on somebody, you've made the decision, it's loss of limb or save the life. And so right now, to me, you're saving my life, and I'm going to lose my arm. And he's like, well, this isn't the military. And I'm like, oh, yeah, you're right. I guess I wasn't being very mindful, huh? Yeah, there are no bullets being shot and bombs going off, right? But tourniquet to me meant one thing. You're going to lose your arm. You're going to lose whatever we're putting this tourniquet on to save your life. He just wanted to slow down the blood flow so I could get to the hospital and have enough blood left to go through all the surgeries that he knew I was going to go through. But it scared the heck out of me, and it really did hurt a lot. Like, that was a level of pain that I don't know if I ever want to feel again. See, here I'm doing the... I didn't say I couldn't do it again, but I'm saying wouldn't want to do it again, even though the second time through is always easier than the first, because you kind of know what's coming, and there's less fear involved.
Well, on a less intense... Well, a different intense level, but probably less intense, actually. That rule has applied huge for me in my relationship with nicotine, because not even realizing it, that's how I've been doing it. I have a craving, and I address the craving head on, and I say, yeah, we used to do that. We don't do that anymore.
I love it.
And it takes about that long to go through the loop. And you go, and you do it 2 or 3 times, and the energy's no longer there. You know, it just literally vanishes. It doesn't, you know, at that level. Now, when you're talking pain at the level you were dealing with, I don't think the pain goes away, like, vanishes, but you did talk about the fact that over time it completely radically altered how you were dealing with the feeling of the experience.
Mm-hmm.
As it has for me, you know, now it's in fascination where I'm going, well, where did that come from? Because I've been away from it long enough now that when it shows up, like, where the hell did you come from? Yeah, well, thanks for showing up, but we still don't do that. But thanks for coming by.
Right.
Yeah. So it's a very powerful process.
Yep. The I'm being somehow led to backtrack a little and want to just touch for another moment on wants and needs.
Mm.
And also connecting that to the belief that we haven't gotten what we've needed. And so when I'm presenting this in an audience of my peers at a continuing education workshop, or you know, just other places I've presented this material, I'll ask the audience, after I've asked the question, does anybody believe they don't have what they need right now? And there's always some people that give an example, and I say, okay, well, somebody said, yeah, I need somebody to pay my mortgage. And I'm like, right now, in this 8 seconds? And they're like, yeah, it's late. And I go, well, let's test that. And you know, 8 seconds goes by, and I'm like, well, did your mortgage get paid? And they're like, no. I'm like, well, you don't need your mortgage to be paid. You don't even need a house. There's plenty of people walking around tonight that don't have a house because they don't need one. We're getting our wants and our needs confused all the time. All the time. I used an absolute there. So then I go to the Does anybody here in the audience think that there was ever a time in their life that they didn't get what they needed? And almost everybody puts their hand in the air, and some people are like, yeah, of course that's happened. I'm like, well, then how would we be here? And little by little, people will put their hands down. But there's some that still insist that they're the exception. And that there was something that happened that they didn't get their need met. And they want to talk about it. And they're just hanging on to it like a bulldog. I'm not letting this go!
What do you think are, what are the greatest attachment? What's the greatest, what did you find consistently were the greatest wants that were disguised as needs?
It's, I wanted my parents to be different than they were. And I remember, and it made me cry, and it was so intense. The guy was sitting right there, asked him that question, and he said, yeah, I needed my dad not to sodomize me when I was a young boy. And I didn't go right after it, but I heard him say, I needed my dad not to do that, right? Mm. And I paused for a moment. He started tearing up. I started tearing up, you know, because I connect. I'm empathic. Mm-hmm. I tune in. And I gently responded back with saying, I know you wanted your dad to show up differently for you than he did. But he couldn't, and he didn't. But the good news is, you're working with somebody now that can help you remediate that, overcome it, process it. And I'm not ever and would never say you needed for that to happen. That's a whole different issue. But I am saying you wanted a different father. You wanted your father to show up for you differently than he did. But the universe said, you didn't need that. And how do I know? Because you're here. And you endured it. And somehow, whether there was agreements or alignment or the divinity or the intelligent design, I don't know how all that works. I have my suspicions. I have what works for me. But I don't really know. But I do know that if that happened to you, and I believe that it did, it's okay. It's okay that that happened. You're here now. Let's be here now. Let's do the work. We'll get that out of the amygdala. We believe that traumatic memories, the amygdala might have something to do with that. For me, there's a better explanation that it's in our field, that the memory's in the field, not necessarily in a body part, but it doesn't matter. It's somewhere. We can clearly access it. It's clear, there's clearly a stimulus and a response there that's happening. But regardless of whether it's in the amygdala or in the field, we can go back and remediate it and process it, desensitize it, and it clears and it goes away. And it's like, you will never be molested by another man in your life. You may be raped, you may be murdered, there may be other things that show up in your life, but it won't be that, and it won't go down that way. And you now have resources. And I actually, you know, create a virtual experience for them where they can go back as their present self and plug themselves into that scenario and play it through again in their mind, and it clears. They actually demonstrate it in front of their younger self. So it's like I create this avatar of their present self and their younger self together in their mind. Mm-hmm. And they go back and we go through the experience again. And the younger self is always amazed and just so happy that the present self is showing up and can easily see the difference between the resources present self has with younger self. And present self always rocks, always rises to the occasion, always does the right thing, and it clears. It's like I'm using absolutes again because that's what my experience is. So all that was to say, to backtrack a little bit on this thing that we're getting our wants and our needs confused, like constantly. We get what we need. So anytime we're upset, we're focused on a want, not a need. If we need it, it will show up. I truly, truly, truly believe that with all my heart. I don't need to work to get my needs met. I don't need to do anything to get my needs met. They will be met. If I never worked another day in my life, eventually I would get evicted from my office. Eventually I'd be sitting out on the corner somewhere. Eventually somebody would come by and give me a blanket and a sandwich. And eventually the cops would come pick me up and take me to jail for a while. And then I'd get plugged into a homeless center somewhere. I'd figure it out and the universe would show up. If I did nothing, I would still eat and I'd still sleep somewhere. And I would continue on. I would. It's just how it works. Mm-hmm. And there's plenty of people having that experience.
Yep.
We get what we need. That's the mantra that I encourage people to practice, to be mindful. I have what I need now. We could kind of do a little summary. You keep saying that to yourself over and over and over and over again. You're going to be thinking something. You may as well be thinking that.
Mm-hmm.
I've always gotten what I've needed. I have what I need now. I will get what I need when I need it.
My personal favorite is that everything is always working out for me.
Yes, same, love it.
Same destination. Equally as impactful.
Sounds like Abraham Hicks thing.
It is.
Yeah.
It is.
Yeah.
One that I adopted a long time ago.
So people that are anxious and worried have the mantra, I'm not going to get what I need when I need it. Their thoughts are in the future. Right? So anxious people, the feeling of anxiousness is about the future.
Mm-hmm.
The goal is, come back to now.
Right.
I have what I need now.
Mindfulness is the ability to recognize when you've crossed either into the future, into the past,
mm-hmm.
and to say, oh,
mm-hmm.
time out.
Mm-hmm.
I want to be here.
Right.
And I was watching a video. I had a very interesting exercise that I thought was brilliant in its simplicity. What did he call it? The three steps? Three. I have to go back and look. I can't remember what he called it. It was a three cycles. But anyway, the whole point was, if you're going into a place where you're either going into the future or the past, you're going into some anxiety, you're going into some depression, whatever the case may be, is that you pick three things in the immediate environment. Any three things. Microphone, bottle, computer. And you put your focus on that, and you say, that's a microphone. And you take a deep breath. You say, that's a bottle. You take a deep breath. You say, that's a computer. Deep breath. Completely refocuses your attention into the present moment. And sometimes you have to do it over and over and over again. You know, if you've gotten yourself amped up, it may take more than three. You may have to do it another cycle of three or do nine or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
But I like the simplicity of it because it's not about, oh, find that thought and root it out and change it and fix it. It's just, no, just stop putting your attention other than right here. And the way you do that is to bring your attention to what's right here. And I like the simplicity of that because it's not going to solve all your problems, but it'll get you out of the past or the present so you can be here. Now you can focus on, where do you want to go from here? I'm fine. I have what I need. Because right now, that experience of connecting to now eliminates all the things that aren't there. And you go, oh, okay, yeah. I got clothes. And I can go pee if I need to.
Mm-hmm.
I have something to drink. I'm good right now, this moment.
Yep.
It's 8 seconds.
Got what I need.
I like that a lot.
So the people that are living in the past, in their thoughts, thinking the thought, I didn't get what I needed when I needed it, or someone did me wrong, kind of thing. The emotion primarily is going to be anger, or any of the cousins of anger, resentment, bitterness, frustration.
Lower down the tone scale, actually.
Mm-hmm.
Regret.
There could be some shame and guilt involved, whether it's yourself, self-other, or God. So it's really interesting when you take the emotions, and we're talking about basic emotions, worry and boredom and anxiety. Boredom is a little different than anxiety and worry. Worry and anxiety are similar. They're just, you know, different ways of kind of saying the same thing, but it's based on the, I'm not going to get what I need when I need it. So it's interesting when you take the emotions and you plug them into time, where they are with regard to time. You know, worry can only be about something that hasn't happened yet.
Mm-hmm.
And anger can only be about something that already happened, even if it's only 8 seconds ago. You're not really angry. Because if you're in the moment, if you're truly present, you're going to be content. So if you're angry, and you're angry in the moment, like right now, it's happening right now in this 8 seconds,
mm-hmm.
you're pulling the past. You're just projecting the past right on. You're not being present. And you're being forgetful that I have what I need right now.
Mm-hmm.
Even though somebody's yelling at me and being rude and disrespectful, I don't
don't need everybody to be nice to me. There's plenty of people on the planet that are not going to be nice to me. I have lots of experiences with people not being nice to me. It's no reflection of me. And if it is, I'll figure it out. There'll be enough more people that'll come and present that to me, and I'll look at it at some point.
Well, you even unconsciously said it in your sentence. I don't need them to like me. You didn't even have to consciously choose the word. It came out automatically. I don't need them to like me.
Mm-hmm.
I might want them to.
Right.
But if they're not liking me over there and I'm sitting here, I'm not dying because they're not liking
me. Right. Right. But if I want them to like me and they don't, and I think I need that, I will be angry about it.
Yeah.
So maybe we could talk
self-judgment or judgment.
Yeah. This, what we're doing right now, the application of these things would be, because we did concept tonight, concept and principle, maybe next week we could do a little bit more of the application of it and make it more real. You want to do a wrap-up or a summary for the night? Or just say we're done?
We covered so much topic.
We did.
The idea was that we wanted to lay the foundation for what is mindfulness and kind of look at it from a physiological perspective, how our chemistry works, how our bodies work, to that end, to that place of we have all of these receptors and all of these things that can tell us what's happening in the environment, and through mindfulness we can come to a place of recognizing that we have what we need, and that contentment can be expanded into a state that's different than. And maybe something to look at is whether is contentment would be considered a state, or a state of being. But actually, I think that by definition it was, wasn't it? What I was earlier calling a state of opportunity could be a state of contentment, depending on what your focus is.
Mm-hmm.
If you're looking for something, then maybe opportunity is more the state of opportunity. Being in a state of opportunity is something more than, and the contentment comes from that as well. But anyway, so we were looking at the physical aspects of how signals are sent through the body and through the brain and we talked about back and forth a lot of trying to just give a clearer definition to mindfulness in a way that is reachable and is touchable. That it's not something that is way far out there to gather. It's actually something you can instigate and stimulate right in this moment right now.
Mm-hmm.
And in any moment right now, if you have the tools to know how to do that, you can easily stimulate. And we talked about a couple of those tools. And what else? We looked at...
wants versus needs.
Wants versus needs, huge. That would be an interesting one to dive into.
Yeah.
Although it's funny because the answer will always be the same. But it's fun to talk about because we can see how the mind goes to the past or the present to create significance, to create importance, to create understanding. We've got to look in the history books to understand.
Right.
And recognizing that's really of no value. You can reflect on those things, but you don't want to pull all that luggage into the present because now you then can't be mindful in a room full of bags.
I would go so far as to say there would have never been a war fought or a murder committed if the people choosing those actions would have figured out their wants and their needs.
Mm. Okay, Tony Robbins. I think that's actually a core tenet of his.
Is it? Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah, he. I think he's broken it down further, though. He's broken down the needs and broken down so that you can identify your personality or being type through those needs to find out what you, because the needs are specific to the individual. So there may be you may have a need for love that I don't have.
Mm-hmm.
And I may have a need for acceptance that you don't have. know, or a need for whatever, you know, whatever. I don't know what they are. Mm. If anybody breaks them down, it'd be fun. But
the universe would say, if you need it, it will come to you exactly when you need it.
Mm-hmm.
And if you really think you need it and it's not showing up for you, that's the universe saying, you don't need it right now. Maybe next week. Once you can let it be a want and not a need, then the universe can let it show up for you.
Well, that speaks too of the attachment we have that as you go into the future, you know, that I won't be complete without that in the future. You know. But more things we can dive into later. But the point of that being that it's it all comes back to mindfulness is about bringing us, how do we get present? How do we get present right here, right now?
It's about being in the now, in the moment, being present.
Yep. Because everything that will take place has to take place from there. Anything that doesn't take place from now isn't sustainable.
Yeah.
And will not create any kind of definitive change. It'll just create chaos.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So it's been a good talk.
Yeah. So folks, to whet your appetite or make you hungry to tune in next week, where we will land next week is people are constantly telling me when I'm teaching this is, well, wait a minute, I'm feeling anxious right now, or I'm feeling angry right now. You can't tell me I'm not feeling this right now. And then it's help, because they are having right now in this moment experiences, but they're not being present. We'll get to talk about that next week. That there's I talked about a seamless overlap between the part of the 8 seconds that's in the now and the tail end that's in the past, that's still a little bit of it in the now. We'll clean that up a little bit and go into that a little bit more.
Well, yeah, because you can bring anything you want in the now.
And we do.
We do.
All right. Good night, everybody.
Good night. Thank y'all.
We hope you enjoyed this episode of Adventures in Truth podcast. If you would like to listen to more or to explore all our offerings, visit us on the web at www.adventuresintruthpodcast.com. We also offer video versions of our podcast. Visit our page on YouTube at Adventures in Truth Podcast. We would love to hear from you. Like, connect, and follow with us on Facebook. Want to book us for your next podcast or to speak at your event? Head over to our webpage at www.adventuresintruthpodcast.com at the bottom of the page and send us a note. Thank you so much for listening. We look forward to seeing you again at Adventures in Truth Podcast.